show today, but I'm also going to be joined by two experts of Central and South American football. That's right, joining us later on, Mr. Rupert Fryer will be talking all things South American football. Rupert, of course, a lead writer for ESPN, The Football Ramble, The Observer, The Guardian, and the co-founder of southamericanfootball.co.uk. You can find him at Rupert Fryer, capital R and capital F. But coming up, and actually on the line now waiting for us, she is a lady who knows all things Mexican football. I guess we have Jackie Oatley, the queen of football. We have, of course, Rebecca Lowe on the show. She is, of course, now the first lady of football. So I guess the lady joining me now is La Reina del Fútbol. Of course, it is Miss Kim Tate, Mexican football expert, joining us here on World Football Daily to talk all things El Tri and their chances of making it to next summer's big show. Kim, it's a pleasure to have you on today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure as always. Now, first and foremost, we like to kind of introduce any new guests on World Football Daily we have to the audience. So tell us a little bit about yourself, about what has drawn you to Mexican football in general?
Well, I've always been interested in the Mexican sport. I was, you know, to go into a personal side of things, I was raised in a single parent household. My mom worked three jobs just to put food on the table. And, you know, a majority of my time was spent at my best friend's house with her Mexican family. So, you know, I've always felt very comfortable around the Mexican culture. As I got older, I became more interested in the Mexican culture, and I've always loved football, or soccer as we call it here in America. So, you know, just recently over the last years, I've been covering it a little more intimately in trying to decide on a direction for myself as a professional. I figured that, you know, Mexico just kind of fit. There's not really a lot of American broadcasters, not a ton of American journalists covering the sport as substantively as I feel that it deserves. So I figured, why not give it a shot? It's been really enjoyable. I went to my first Mexico game in the Gold Cup against Panama here in California at the Rose Bowl in July. And just before that, I'd seen my first Cholos versus Club America game at Petco Park. It was a friendly, but nonetheless, it was a good time. So here I am.
I'm sure there are plenty of people that are extremely jealous about your trips already into Liga MX, and of course the trip to the Gold Cup as well. Before we get into Mexico and their chance of getting to Brazil 2014, we were discussing a little earlier on the show, Kim, about the idea of Januzaj joining and pledging his future to English football. Now, in US soccer, the US men's national team has had a number of players that maybe haven't even been born in the US, aren't too affiliated to the US despite their eligibility to play for the country. When you're watching the US men's national team, if there's a number of players in the same position as Januzaj who are playing for the US men's national team, do you find it detracts slightly from being kind of drawn to the US men's national team as a fan?
No, I mean, when you're talking about the U.S. national team, this is a really tricky subject. This is one that's stirred a lot of debate. You know, I know historically it's been possible for players to play for different national teams, even if they weren't born or even if they hadn't lived in that country for a substantial period of time. You know, I can name a ton of players who have played for, you know, their birth country and then have gone on 3 or 4 years later to play for a country where they never even lived. And, you know, I don't know that this is an exact quote, so don't quote me 100% on this, but
sure.
I recall Jurgen Klinsmann saying something like, you know, America is, you know, a melting pot of cultures, and that's sort of what this team has become. But, you know, speaking to the point that Jack Wilshere was trying to make, I don't really think that a lot of our players, you know, were born in other countries and then came to America, only lived here for 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden they're playing for us. You know, I think that there's more of a deep-rooted nationality to the United States for the U.S. men's national team than in this particular situation. As a fan, it doesn't really affect whether or not I root 100% for the national team. It doesn't really affect my criticism of them. If I'm going to criticize the national team, it's going to be for something completely different. I'm not really too worried about that. But, you know, back to the point with eligibility and nationality and all that, I know that in 2004, FIFA had kind of made a change and said, okay, well, you know, we're going to set forth a new set of rules that are a little bit more stringent and, you know, set additional requirements that are going to determine which country a player can represent. And I think to some extent you have to have some restrictions. You know, to quote Sepp Blatter.
Oh, yes, a fantastic man to quote here, Kim, yeah.
Everybody's favorite executive in football. In 2007 or 2008, I think, you know, he told the BBC, if we don't stop this, you know, players just who were born in one country and have, you know, dual nationalities in another, and they just want to, you know, jump toward another country because they want to represent that country, then by the time we reach the 2014 or 2018 World Cups, out of the 32 teams, you're going to have 16 full of Brazilian players, you know, and that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So, like I said, it's kind of a touchy subject, but I can see where Jack Wilshere is coming from, definitely. I mean, there are a lot of guys who are English who are competing for a spot on that squad. And to have someone who isn't English come in, especially if what he did for Manchester United last week continues on, you know, it's probably looked at as unfair. But then again, you know, it's not really a new concept to national team eligibility. So
I wonder if Jack's just a little worried about maybe losing his place already in the England side. We'll have to wait and see how that issue goes as we continue to wait and see if Janisai will pledge his future to England and, of course, won't be eligible for another few years just yet. Maybe Jack's just getting a little worried, though. Kim, let's get on to a little bit of Mexican football and talk about this Mexican national side that really are in a vital stage taking on Panama this weekend. Has to be a win, surely. You know, this is do or die time for the Mexican national side. They've changed managers in the last month or so. Obviously, Chepo de la Torre out. Is it too little too late for Mexico, Kim?
I don't think it's too little too late. I do think that they're going to qualify, but they're going to do it in dramatic fashion. I think Alexi Lawless summed it up really well recently in saying, you know, Mexico just doesn't put the fear in God into anybody when they're playing anymore, and certainly not in CONCACAF right now. And he's right. You know, gone are the days when teams actually feared playing Mexico. I mean, they're a mess. I think psychologically, you know, whatever went on with that team under Chepo de la Torre, there was no team chemistry. What was once a team of cohesion is now at times looking like they have no idea what to do with the ball. So having Vucetich come in, you know, he's made a lot of changes already. Ahead of the World Cup qualifiers, he held camps Monday through Wednesday where he called in a bunch of different players just to kind of see, you know, who really gelled, you know, who had the potential to maybe win a starting role that hadn't been present before. He's certainly decorated. You know, he's won 13 of 14 finals. He's won two Segunda División titles in Mexico. He's done, you know, great historically in CONCACAF, and now his World Cup qualifying selections, you know, kind of speak to his experience, I guess. You know, he's called in a lot of guys from Tigres in Monterrey, where he was a coach for so long, you know, Leon, calling back in Rafa Marquez for that real strong veteran leadership and experience. You know, I already like the changes that he's made in comparison with Chepo. So, like I said, I think they can get the job done, but, you know, they've got their work cut out for them. They need to score a lot of goals against Panama. You know, they've won one game in 8 matches, 2 losses, drawn 5, but, you know, they failed to win at home in this qualification, which is huge. And they've lost to Panama already twice this year, so they've got, like I said, they've got their work cut out for them, especially against Panama, but I think they can do it.
Is that going to prey on this Mexican side kind of mentality going into this game, though? The fact that what was such a fortress, the Azteca, has been broken so dramatically over the last few months, that's got to be a big mental challenge for them.
Yeah, it is a big mental challenge, isn't it? And hopefully Vucetich can sort of reinstill that confidence into his players. And hopefully they can go into it with confidence. I mean, a a win at the Azteca against Panama, scoring 2, 3, 4 goals would be really nice, wouldn't it? It'd be a great confidence booster for them.
It would surely settle the camp. You mentioned Rafa Márquez coming back in and the important role that he can play as an experienced leader. Obviously, as well, Guillermo Ochoa coming back into it as well. But no room, surprisingly, for Carlos Vela, who was many expected to see coming back. Are you surprised by the selection of Vucetic, to not bring back Carlos Vela into the Celtics side?
Carlos Vela, you know, it's unfortunate to see this type of saga. It's so dramatic. The way that it's played out has been really interesting because the national team could definitely use him. And I think all Mexico fans out there will agree with me that, you know, to have Vela, Dos Santos, and an informed Chicha out there with an option like an Oribe Peralta on the bench, it's a dream. But unfortunately, it's not going to play out that way. And, you know, this whole thing with Vela has gone back 2 years at least to 2011, where he had a feud with Chepo. Vucetic did actually call him in when he called up Memo Ochoa, and both accepted the call-in. You know, there was a positive response there from both players, and that was really nice to see because, you know, people had been protesting, you know, why isn't Chepo calling in Vela? And then also to see, you know, Memo Ochoa finally agree to a call-up. You'd think that, you know, the common denominator there was Chepo. But... you know, there's reports flying around that, you know, Vela recently told Hector Inarritu, who's the director of national team selections, that he wasn't ready to represent El Tri because he's not fit. So that seemed a little bit odd. But then when you dig back, you know, you look at other excuses we've heard from him, like he didn't want to come in because he's not getting along with other players, or he's having problems with the FMF, the Mexican Football Federation. You know, he's even tossed around claims that he was unfairly treated by El Tri on past appearances. So, you know, you can blame, I know people have blamed Chepo, but when you start to look at all of Vela's excuses, you almost wonder if there's a little bit more than what meets the eye. I mean, he's performing well for Real Sociedad in La Liga. He recently scored in UCL. You know, he had 12 goals out of 35 appearances in his first season for Real Sociedad, 14 the following season in 35 games. He spent time in EPL at Arsenal, so it's really unfortunate to see a talent like Vela, you know, not be utilized by the Mexican national team. I know that Vucetic did want him in there, but at this point it's kind of like, you know, we've given you every opportunity to, you know, get over it and have the chance to come back. And, you know, if you're not going to take it, then unfortunately, you know, maybe that ship has sailed for Carlos Vela. You know, there's a possibility that we may not see him come back, which is really unfortunate. But I think that, you know, we've got some pretty good options up front. You know, we've got Chicharito Hernandez, you know, Oribe Peralta, who's been in great form this season. He was great in the Olympics as well, you know. So he's got some good players that can take his place, but to not have him in the squad is definitely disappointing.
We do, as you say, have Javier Hernandez and Giovanni Dos Santos as well. A lot relying on both these two players. Dos Santos finally getting some regular first-team football, but Hernandez has been out of the United side for the majority of the start of this season under David Moyes and has been struggling for play in general at the Red Devils. Do you think that's had a hindrance on his appearances for the national team, the fact that Hernandez hasn't ingrained himself as a first 11 player at Manchester United consistently?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it definitely has an effect on his performance. I mean, but the thing is, you know, he's Mexico's top striker, you know, who's out there playing internationally right now. The fact that, you know, in the last three starts that he's had for Manchester United, he's scored in every single one of those. I mean, he's got 3 goals in as many starts. That's promising. You know, we saw what he did when he started in that, I think it was a Champions League game. He scored a great goal. You know, it's great to know that he's still got it, but at the same time, yeah, you definitely want a striker and, you know, the guy that you depend on to score a majority of your goals. You want him to be getting playing time with his club. And, you know, right now for me, Oribe Peralta with Santos Laguna is ahead of him. You know, the real trick is going to be whether or not, or seeing whether or not Vucetic is able to get Peralta and Chicha playing together, because, you know, historically they've never really had that chemistry together. You know, individually they can both score goals all day long, but, you know, together they haven't really had that chemistry. Going back to Chicha's situation at Manchester United, you know, he was recently quoted saying, you know, he's going on 4 years there. You know, he said, I'm really happy to be able to play for one of the best clubs in the world. I'm doing my best every single day to earn more minutes on the pitch. You know, having to compete with players like Robin Van Persie and Wayne Rooney only makes me a better player. And there's some truth to that. But I think that, you know, David Moyes has made it pretty clear that Chicha is, you know, his maybe third option for striker at best. Some would even argue that maybe he's his fourth choice. So
Hernandez behind Danny Welbeck at Manchester United. I never thought I'd see that, because I'm a big fan of Hernandez and his striking ability in front of goal. Finally, Kim, we can't let you go without giving us a prediction on your opening appearance here on World Football Daily. We've got the Panama game coming up on Saturday night, UK time, of course, Friday evening out on your side of the globe. And, of course, the game against Costa Rica. But we'll just leave it for the Panama game for now. Mexico in the Azteca against Panama. What's it going to be, Kim?
I'm going to predict a 2-1 score in favor of Mexico. I think that Vucetich will get their confidence up. You know, it's definitely difficult to play at Azteca, and I think there's a lot weighing on this game, so the environment is going to be especially hostile. You know, I think some of the changes we'll definitely see some changes in tactics. It'll be helpful to have Rafa Márquez back if he starts. That would be great, because, you know, with his experience at Barcelona, he can kind of build an attack out of the back. You know, I think we're going to see a different Mexico squad, and I'm confident that they can pull out at least 2 goals. I'm going 2-1 Mexico.
Wow, that got more and more confident as you went there with that last answer. I definitely think you're growing in confidence as we get towards that big Panama game, but we'll have to wait until tomorrow night for that. Kim, thank you so much for joining us here on World Football Daily. We appreciate you taking the time out. We will let you get back to, I'm sure, your busy desk planning and preparing your coverage of El Tri and their big games coming up in World Cup qualification, Kim. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Kim Tate there joining us here on World Football Daily. Freelance writer talking all things Mexican football. And, of course, Mexico with those big games coming up against Panama and Costa Rica in World Cup qualification. Sat outside of the qualification positions at this moment in time. But it's still a possibility that they will be able to get the job done and make their way to Brazil 2014. The US men's national team are already there. And of course, there's plenty more to be decided. We're going to be going through the whole of Europe in a second, but we do have to talk somewhere that maybe we haven't looked at in a little bit of time. It is, of course, a little bit of South American football. And of course, there's still plenty to be decided in the South American World Cup qualifiers. We have just the man to talk all things South American football with us. Joining us today on World Football Daily, a man who really should need no introduction, because we've had him on the show a number of times now. Joining me to talk all things South American football, an accomplished freelance writer, Mr. Rupert Fryer, joining us here on World Football Daily to chat about everything south of the border. Rupert, it's a pleasure to have you back on World Football Daily, my good man. How excited are you about the start of the finale, if you will, of the South American qualification group?
It's business time.
It is business time, so to speak. We're not almost done here. There's still plenty to be settled in CONMEBOL, because Uruguay have had such a rocky qualification process. Are you surprised how much they have struggled with this whole saga across the last 14 games?
Yes and no. Surprised, yes, because obviously probably if you're looking at the World Cup and then the subsequent Copa America, you could probably argue that they were the best side in South America. In fact, I'd categorically say that. I think Brazil and Argentina were both in transition. Colombia were struggling. And yeah, I think Uruguay were certainly the strongest team on the continent. We had an inkling this might happen, really. It was an aging squad, that one that went to the semi-finals of the World Cup and claimed the Copa America. And then there was a lot of emphasis in Uruguay put on the Olympics. The Olympics was supposed to be a big deal. I know it's not necessarily viewed as a huge competition in Europe, but for South America, it's a huge deal. And especially so for Uruguay, it was supposed to be the time in which they could sort of bring all these younger guys through. And, the Olympics was a complete disaster, really. I saw them a couple of times and they were quite awful. So then we kind of knew, you know, back they might be in a little bit of trouble. But even so, I didn't necessarily expect them to struggle just as much as they did. I mean, they went, I think six qualifiers or so without a win. So yeah, they were really looking in trouble a few rounds ago.
It was all going very horribly for them, but suddenly form's been picked up again, and they have to now go on the road though to this vital game against Ecuador, in Ecuador, fourth and fifth, battling it out for those automatic spots to Brazil 2014. How difficult is it in South America in general? Give us a picture just to go on the road because of the changes in altitude, the huge distance travelled across the continent for these games.
Yeah, very much so. They're a great equaliser, really. And yes, home advantage really is that in South America. Obviously, there are vast distances, as you said, changes in climate. Uruguay will have to go all the way up to Quito, where they might have a few problems. A couple of Uruguayan teams did, I recall, when over those couple of years when LDU were doing so fantastically well in continental competition. So yeah, it's not going to be easy for Uruguay. They know that, but they tend to thrive when their backs are against the wall, Uruguay. You know, they really dig in. It's something of a cliche, but that old sort of Garacharua mentality sort of has really come through. And that's what a lot of the guys have been talking about over the past month or so. Now they're really just trying to keep up this momentum. I mean, they come to a complete halt, as we know, with that terrible run that they had to endure. But yeah, things are going a lot better for them now. They won three games in a row now. Now it's just a case of really heading there and trying to keep that momentum going.
And they play an Ecuador side that really is a side that hasn't maybe caught people by surprise, but is certainly one of the most emphatic Ecuador sides that we've seen in a long time and playing some incredible football. Have you been slightly taken aback by how competent they have looked throughout this qualification process? Or is this maybe something that we've expected with this group of players kind of reaching a peak altogether, if you will?
Yes, perhaps so. I mean, the other thing is not just Ecuador, but the Confederation as a whole. We were pretty much expecting this round to be highly competitive all the way through. We've had a couple of disappointments. I've been particularly disappointed by Peru, in fact. Sergio Macarian came in and did a wonderful job throughout the Copa America, and I was really hoping they would kick on. That hasn't happened. Paraguay were sort of all but done, really, following the Copa America. They got to the final without winning a single game. Tata Martino, he knew their time was up there. He knew where they were finished, and obviously got out while the going was good. So they've really, really, really struggled. A number of the other teams, they knew they were really in with a good chance this round. I mean, I'd probably say this is possibly... In fact, I would say this is the most competitive qualifying campaign I think the World Cup as a whole has ever seen. When we first arrived, you know, in round one, it was anybody's, really. I mean, Bolivia obviously lack a lot of quality, but again, they have the dizzy heights of La Paz, which was such a tremendous equaliser. They've sort of done that thing they traditionally do, where it's just a horrible place to go, and they take points away from the teams who are really vying for those qualification places. I do expect Ecuador to compete. They've sort of been up and down. We've had a couple of runs where they've just looked fabulous, and a couple of where perhaps not so much. But they've been great fun also. I mean, not least Jefferson Montero, who's been wonderful fun to watch. Really, really great player. Well, perhaps not a great player, but terrific fun. I mean, one-on-one, he's incredible. He's just been taking everybody on for fun, running past three or four players. And yeah, it's a bit of a shame that he can't really finish or find that final ball, because if he could, it'd be something special.
For South American qualification, you said that you described it as the most contested, hotly contested qualification the World Cup's ever seen. Why is that? Is that because teams have caught up with the likes of Argentina to an extent? Of course, they have done extremely well and been reasonably dominant in this qualification process. But has South American football improved as a whole, and that makes it one of the stronger kind of federations going into the World Cup, especially down in South America? Or is it more of a case of it is just the kind of the home field advantage, if you will, that is making, as you described earlier, the great leveller?
No, I think that does play a part, obviously. If that wasn't the case, again, sort of the likes of Bolivia, I don't think would really be able to compete. I was saying that they do necessarily sometimes go sort of away and dig in and find some points. But the biggest thing, of course, has been CONMEBOL's move into one big qualifying group. I mean, normally you're only as good as your competition, and it just raised the level of competition for everybody. It gave everybody competitive games. And I mean, if you really want to see a true example of that, you only need to look at Venezuela, who, a little over a decade ago, were really sort of a San Marino equivalent. But since then, they've come on in leaps and bounds. And again, it looks like they're gonna struggle now. They've got a 6-goal swing, I think, to try and make that playoff space. So that's not going to happen. They are just going to narrowly miss out. But to look at how far they've come, and they've put a lot of resources into football ever since they hosted a Copa America, both sort of monetary and just getting bodies involved. There's been a few things that have happened now. I think Juan Arango had a huge impact. He was perhaps their sort of David Beckham, shall we say. He was their first proper Venezuelan superstar. So they've done fabulously well. It's a bit of a shame, really, for them that they're going to miss out. But I think it's just playing these competitive games constantly, where you're constantly playing against strong competition. And I think it's raised the level overall.
You have to be very careful when discussing Juan Arango here on World Football Daily, because, of course, we don't want people to think that it's Juan Arango from the Mad About Football Boys that's been such a heavy influence on Venezuelan football, of course. Rupert,
we were discussing him just now for a second, and I thought, oh, God, have I dropped the wrong name in there?
I tell you what, I mean, who knows? We do not know exactly what he does down there in Miami. He could be pulling the strings of Venezuelan football without us knowing it, Rupert. But no, definitely not Wham from World Football Daily and Goal TV that we're talking about there. You just never know. You never know. Talking of going into this World Cup then, I know we're obviously many months away. It's coming up next summer, of course. But when we went into World Cup 94, there was a lot of talk surrounding sides like Colombia from South America. People were saying that, you know, there were these teams, these up-and-coming teams from South America that had a very slight outside possibility of winning the whole thing. When you look at the South American teams in general that have already qualified, Chile, Colombia, Argentina, and of course it's going to be Ecuador, Uruguay, or Venezuela going into it. Are all of these sides, with it being down in South America, at this moment in time, do you think potential winners of this?
Perhaps not. Colombia have undoubtedly raised their game, and sort of to pick up upon what you were saying earlier about the 1994 World Cup, I mean, Pelé, shall we say, a lot of people kind of make fun of a lot of his predictions, but I think that was one that was right on the money. They thrashed Argentina in Buenos Aires in that qualification campaign, and for my money, they probably did come into that World Cup as possibly the strongest team in the world, certainly the strongest in South America. It's a wonderful team, and obviously lots of things went wrong there, not just necessarily on the pitch, but there's a lot of off-field things that sort of played against them, shall we say, cool, during that campaign. But they're another side who have really, really come on strong throughout this qualification campaign, looking ahead to Brazil. Jose Pekerman's come in and done a brilliant job. I think the key thing he really did, for all the talk of James Rodriguez and Falcao and the likes of sort of the biggest stars, I think the most important player for my money for Colombia has been Magnelli Torres. I mean, when Jose Pekerman came in, he immediately sort of assessed their biggest problem, which was ball retention. They really, really struggled for a player who just put his foot on the ball and just retained possession, just slow the pace down a little bit and get the other side running. At one point, I remember when we were going into the Copa America, I was hoping that Gio Moreno might be that guy. His career has kind of gone downhill a little bit, and he suffered a bad injury before that competition. But yeah, bringing in, shall we say, sort of a proper 10, I think, has really helped Colombia, and they look extremely strong. So I imagine that there will be a team that nobody will be wanting to face in Brazil next year. Aside from that, I mean, Chile, I think it'll be a stretch too far for Chile, but they're going to be great fun again. I think they're going to win a lot of fans like they did in the previous World Cup. Jorge Sampaoli is now really, really got them sort of playing the way he wants them to be playing. Obviously, they beat Spain in a friendly, which was a huge result. Had a couple of really good results in qualification and look set to grab their place as well.
You mentioned the off-the-field kind of issues that Colombia had going into that 94 World Cup, and anybody that's seen the ESPN documentary The Two Escobars will know and have some idea of those issues. Does that still, and I'm asking this purely from a fan's point of view, Rupert, does that still affect Colombian football? Obviously not in the same way, but are there still those outside influences in the game in Colombia?
Nowhere near to that extent. I mean, you remember that was a time when everyone was referring to, throughout South America, was referring to Colombia as Low-Cumbia, you know, crazy Colombia. They had some real social issues there at the time. Obviously, nowhere near as bad as it was then. But I think exactly sort of the total catastrophe of that tournament really is something that they'll be thinking about. It's something that will be on some of the players' minds. It is something that has been discussed a lot. I mean, football is just a 22 guys kicking a ball around a field without any context. So of course that does come into play, and they know that you know, this is the highest the expectations have been of the nation since then. So I don't necessarily envisage a collapse like that for them. I think they'll be fine. I think they'll do really well. I think they're one of the dark horses who could probably go quite a long way.
Let's hope so indeed for Colombian football's sake, because it's some fantastic football that they do play. Obviously, the kings of South American qualifier at the moment are Argentina. Already booked their place, top of the group as well, of course. And really, for the Argentines, are they now just spending a lot of time with one eye on Lionel Messi and his fitness at this moment in time? Because can Argentina win this World Cup if Lionel Messi does end up having that horrible season that nobody wants to see him have, but everybody's almost kind of been expecting the way he runs himself ragged every single year?
Yeah, well, he never seemed to be injured, did he, for a long time? Just Messi seemed to have been playing every single game all the time. Mm. Obviously, he's picked up a couple of knocks. He's got one now, obviously, which means he's dropped out of the squad for these games. so, yeah, I mean, an injury problem. I think it's not necessarily just a thing about Argentina. I think if Lionel Messi was playing for any team in the ladies, well, we've seen it with Barcelona, really, perhaps more so last year than this. But yeah, to lose a player of Messi's pedigree would be a huge problem for any team.
But does it stop them from having a chance of winning it? That's, I mean, without Messi, can Argentina still go in with that same confidence?
Well, no, they certainly can't go in with the same confidence. I think they could still compete. But yeah, I think Messi is sort of that X factor. He is the one that does make them one of the favourites.
What about for Brazil as well? We've discussed a couple of times on the show before the fact that because they are automatically in the World Cup could actually be a big hindrance to them. How have you assessed the way that they've treated these friendly games during international breaks? Do you think that there is a competitive enough mentality as qualification comes to an end from the Brazil side of things, considering they haven't had a competitive game of football since Confederations Cup, and it's been longer than since then, really?
Well, I was concerned. I was certainly concerned for them prior to Luis Felipe Scolari's appointment. But they've, after, I mean, what they had that loss to England at Wembley, but they've really kicked on. Obviously, they had the wonderful, wonderful Confederations Cup tournament, which was really capped off with that victory over Spain, which would have pleased Scolari more than anyone, I think. For a number of reasons, but they've got real, real momentum now, and I think Scolari is, I mean, it's also almost becomes a bit of a cliche when you look back to 2002, but we still talk about the Scolari family, about that wonderful, that real tight-knit group that he brought together, of which, of course, he was the patriarch. And I think that's something he's doing now. If you look at a few of the players just this week since they landed in Seoul, in South Korea, Luis Gustavo was saying how pleased he is that Lucas Leiva's back in the squad, despite him being a competitor for a place. He was saying it's great to have that competition. Oscar, too, has been talking about the momentum that Brazil have been building up and how they need to, with these upcoming qualifiers against South Korea and Zambia, they really need to keep that momentum going, keep that winning mentality in the squad. And I think that is something that Scolari's forged, really. And I think for the other guys coming into the squad now, you've got the likes of Alexander Di Pato, obviously, will be hoping for a place. Lucas Leiva, of course, will be trying to force a place back in that Brazil squad for good, because, I mean, he's been missing since, what, 2011, I think, now. Mm. Because of injury and just not being selected. But everybody's been talking about not only is it important that the new players coming into the group show what they can do on the pitch, they also need to impress Scolari off the pitch, because a World Cup, a tournament like that, everything happens so quickly, you're playing so many games, you're all together for that amount of time. It really is about the group, more so for Scolari than anybody. And so, yeah, I think with these friendlies now, Brazil just need to keep that momentum going. They need to keep winning. They need to retain that winning mentality. I think Scolari will just be looking for those guys now who can really help with this group.
And the mentality off the pitch, very important for Brazil as well. Of course, in their own back garden, hosting a World Cup, they're going to be the centre of attention next summer. Rupert, thank you so much for taking a bit of time to have a chat with us about South American World Cup qualification. I'd love to get into a little bit more with you, but for the time being, we're going to have to run today. However, we hope we can catch up with you very soon after next Tuesday and talk about how it's all ended up as well, mate.
Of course, I'd be delighted. Thanks, thank guys.
You.
Good fun.
Thank you so much, Rupert, for joining us today. Mr. Rupert Fryer joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things South American World Cup qualification and getting into the nitty-gritty, if you will, as we get down to these final few games. The big last two games for everybody in World Cup qualification. Those, though, who make the playoffs will have to suffer through two more knockout games, aggregate football. Gotta love it. You just gotta love it. It's getting so important for these South American European? Damn that Europa League making me mix up stuff.